The scripture reading this morning is going to be from the book of John, chapter 8. John, chapter 8, verses 48 through 58. John, chapter 8, verses 48 through 58. The Jews answered and said to him, "Do we not say rightly that you are a Samaritan and have a demon?" Jesus answered, "I do not have a demon, but I honor my Father, and you dishonor me. But I do not speak of my glory. There is one who seeks and judges. Truly, truly, I say to you, if anyone keeps my word, he will never see death." The Jews said to him, "Now we know that you have a demon. Abraham died and the prophets also, and you say, if anyone keeps my word, he will never taste of death. Surely, you are not greater than our father Abraham who died. The prophets died too. Whom do you make yourself out to be?" Jesus answered, "If I glorify myself, my glory is nothing. But it is my Father who glorifies me, of whom you say, he is our God. And you have not come to know him, but I know him. And if I say that I do not know him, I will be a liar like you. But I do know him and keep his word. Your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it and was glad." So the Jews said to him, "You are not yet 50 years old, and you have seen Abraham?" Jesus said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was born, I am."
This morning we're continuing on our four-part series on reasons to believe in Jesus. From the opening verse from John 20, it says, "Therefore many other signs Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name." This is the ongoing passage we're using as the primary introduction to this. And it brings out the fact that as you look at the scriptures, you look at the life of Christ, it was different than anything else that has been done by man. Even as we look through this, we're kind of used to it, but what this passage brings out is that we're only privy to some of the stuff that Jesus did. I mean, he would almost exhausted himself every day through his three-year ministry, teaching and doing works, miracles, aids, helps for people, casting out demons, just on a constant basis every day. No one had a life like this. No one. And it's kind of sad that, there are millions that believe in Joseph Smith, and he refused to do one miracle. And most of his teachings are borrowed from somebody else, plagiarized. Muhammad didn't do any miracles, yet millions, believe in him. Yet Jesus filled each day with miracles that if just one was done today, would impress us beyond anything and probably cause us to believe in him. Perhaps it's just the fact that so much was done by him that it was just overwhelming and hard to take in. But no one has had a life like his, and that's what we're going to be looking at some of the things this morning. Today, those who come to the person of Jesus Christ with open and honest hearts find powerful evidence that he is God. He fulfilled all the Old Testament prophecies regarding the Messiah. This is kind of the where we left off last week, just kind of a reintroduction. He performed many different kinds of miracles to validate his message. He predicted his own death and resurrection. He accepted worship. He lived a morally perfect, sinless life, and boldly demanded that he had the power on earth to forgive sins. when a person follows all of this evidence to its correct conclusion, he can do no more than what Thomas did, bow down before him and say, "My Lord and my God." But the next sensible question to ask is, what evidence does the Bible give to the deity of Jesus? And that's what the next three lessons are going to be looking at. What is the evidence that's furnished to us by the Father through the Word that we should believe in His Son? First of all, Jesus did fulfill messianic prophecies. While it is true that most people's lives can only be chronicled after they have lived them, name one person whose life was chronicled before he lived. Think about it. But the life of Jesus was miraculously chronicled by divine inspiration long before he even arrived on earth. You know, we know about Jesus from way back. He was introduced in Genesis 3, you know, to Adam and Eve. You know, the one who would crush Satan. We're introduced to him by Moses when he said, "There's going to be a prophet that's going to come, you know, like me, and you're going to listen to him." And then we just got through with a series from Isaiah on the suffering servant. And we're going to be looking at a lot more in these lessons to show everything we knew about Jesus even before he lived incarnate. Such messianic prophecies are proof of both the divine inspiration of the Bible as well as the divine nature of Jesus. The reason that Jesus, the apostles, and the New Testament prophets spent so much of their time teaching and preaching from the Old Testament messianic prophecies is because Jesus was proven to be Christ, the Messiah, by his fulfillment of these prophecies. I mean, it was setting up a kind of list for people that would come later to go, okay, who are we looking for? At the time of Jesus, some speculate there was at least 33 people claiming to be the Messiah. How do you distinguish Jesus from all the rest of them? And the incredible thing is that as you go through the checklist of everything that was predicted about his life came true. You know, you can sit there and go, well, this person drops out, this person drops out, this person. But Jesus is sitting there getting a check mark for every last thing that said that the Messiah is going to be. Jesus fulfilled in minute detail over 300 prophecies that relate to the coming of the Messiah. Space prohibits a listing of all of these prophecies, but a representative sampling is appropriate. And that's what we're going to be looking at. Something you can carry away. Something to show somebody. Something to go over yourself. You know, what are the prophecies? Okay, here's a list. The Messiah was to be born in Bethlehem in Judea, Micah 5:2. Of a virgin, Isaiah 7:14. Now, what's interesting about these sometimes is people go, well, you know, the word there is not really virgin, it's maiden. And they miss the whole point of it. You know, if it is prophesied that it was going to be, he was going to be born of a virgin, and then all that happened was he was born of a maiden, you might go, yeah, something kind of suspicious here. But when it gives a generic and the fulfillment is even more accurate than the prophecy, then you got to step back and go, whoa, there's something incredible going on here. He would be a descendant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and also Judah. In Genesis 22, 26, Numbers 24. Notice multiple prophecies, you know, the same thing from different authors. He was to be a regal monarch, Psalms 89 and Isaiah 9, but at the same time, a suffering servant, Isaiah 53. He was to be betrayed by a friend for 30 pieces of silver, not 29, not 31, 30. very exacting. Nostradamus, in his best day, never got this accurate. The Lord's ruler would come into Jerusalem riding on the foal of a donkey, Zechariah 9:9. He would be buried with the rich, Isaiah 53:9. During his suffering, his clothes would be distributed to those who cast lots for them, Psalms 22. His attackers would pierce him, Zechariah 12:10. Even though his physical suffering would be extensive and severe, his bones would not be broken, which was a normal thing for those crucified. They come by, stick the spear in them, find out if they're still alive. Many were. If they were, then your legs were broken and you'd suffocate from collapsing on yourself. He was already gone. And in spite of his death, his physical body would not experience decay. Psalm 16:10. Quoted by Peter to prove the point. The small sampling of precise prophetic details is only a fraction of the many Old Testament prophecies that exist. The prophecies were significantly designed to be an effective mechanism by which the Jewish community could recognize the Messiah when he came. He fulfilled all of them. Why didn't they accept him? That goes back to also why we don't accept him today, or so many people. We don't want to. We don't want to. Why evolutionists accept evolution as opposed to creation is because they don't want to believe in God. Why? Because it holds them accountable. God holds us accountable. We get our morals from God. I mean, the first atheists that came out were very blatant about this. They didn't want to be accountable to God. They wanted to do what they wanted to do, to sin any way they wanted to sin without any kind of judgment brought upon them. Therefore, they had to convince others, too, in order to be allowed to do this. And, of course, it's caught on in the world. The messianic puzzle began to unfold in the life of Jesus. When all the pieces of the messianic puzzle are put together, one individual stands out as the only person who fulfilled every single prophecy in minute detail. Jesus, the Messiah. The life and activities of Jesus Christ, as recorded in the New Testament, documents brilliantly blend the theme of a regal monarch and a suffering servant into one magnificent portrait of triumph. The things that didn't seem to go together come together in the life of Christ. They form a tapestry that's tightly woven together. They give us a pattern that's undeniable. Jesus was the sacrificial lamb at his death on the cross, who became the triumphant Lion of Judah in his resurrection from the grave. The lineage of Jesus is meticulously traced in order to show that he qualified as the seed of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and of Judah, and of David. Yeah, this is what the chronologies are in Matthew, the genealogies in Matthew 1, Luke 3. We look at these and we go, man, we got to read through this. We got to skip over them and get into the text. But there's a reason for them, especially for the Jews, to prove to the Jews this is exactly the person you're looking for. You can trace his genealogy all the way back to Adam. And in Luke 3, it was apropos for the Gentile as well, because Luke is written for the Gentiles. The narrative detailing his birth verifies that he was indeed born in Bethlehem of Judea, from which city the Messiah would arise, Luke 2, 1-7. The birth narrative also intricately portrays the preexistence of Jesus before time began, fulfilling the prophecy that the Messiah existed before King David. David said this. You know, the Lord said unto my Lord, Peter brings this out. How could he do that? Unless he predated David. The passage of scripture that Jason read, you know, is a from John. You know, again, the book of John was specifically written that you might believe that Jesus was the Christ, the Son of God. That means every story in the Gospel of John, every action that took place, every teaching there, in some way or other, should prove to you that Jesus was the Son of God. Okay? Specifically then in what was written in Acts 8 is that, you know, Jesus said, before Abraham was, I am. He identifies himself with being the voice in the burning bush. He was before Abraham. He was before Moses. Furthermore, Jesus did, in fact, enter Jerusalem riding on the foal of a donkey. The New Testament narratives depicting the death of Jesus Christ verify that Jesus was betrayed by his friend, sold for exactly 30 pieces of silver, Matthew 24. At his death, his bones were not broken. Soldiers cast lot for his garments, and his side was pierced with a spear. All prophesied and verified in the New Testament. During his suffering, he was numbered with the transgressors, Isaiah 53, predicted by being crucified between two thieves. And at his death, he was buried in the tomb of a wealthy man, as was also foretold in Matthew 27. This type of verification could continue for pages. The life of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, as depicted in the New Testament documents, was designed to fulfill the messianic prophecies of the Old Testament. And there's something to be said here, though. A lot of people have looked at these things, at how accurate they are, and suppose something different. Okay, so accurate that the Old Testament narratives must have been written maybe sometime after the New Testament. What's put a lie to that? One is the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls contain at least seven copies, not the original manuscript, but seven copies of the book of Isaiah. And they're dated before the time of Christ. So we've been looking at Isaiah and noticed that a lot of these prophecies are coming from there. By contextual evidence, Isaiah was written about 700, 750. The copies themselves were like 1st or 2nd century B.C., all before the time of Christ, verified. You can add to that the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, written 300 years before the New Testament times. It also contains all the prophecies of the Old Testament. Okay. So the accuracy should be leading you to believe that the Old Testament prophets knew what they were talking about, God was directing them, and making sure it was all fulfilled in the New Testament. Due to this overwhelming congruence of the life of Jesus Christ with the predictive messianic prophecy of the Old Testament, some have suggested that Jesus was an imposter who was able by masterful manipulation, this is the second theory, that he was by manipulation, to artificially organize his life as to make it look like he was the Messiah. Such a contention cannot be reasonably maintained in light of the fact that many of the prophecies were beyond his control. Now, how do you control who your lineage is? It'd be impossible for a person to arrange his ancestors, or where he would be born. Furthermore, it would be near impossible to coordinate events so that he would make sure that he was crucified among thieves. That was the Romans' choice, not his. Also, they'd be buried in a rich man's tomb. That was something that came to Joseph of Arimathea after the fact. How could the betrayal price of Judas be manipulated by Jesus? That was something that was bartered between him and the soldiers or the priests. And how, pray tell, could Jesus have managed to arrange it so that the soldiers, the Roman soldiers, would cast lots for his clothes at the very base of the cross. The idea that Jesus manipulated all these events to make it appear as he was the Messiah not only is indefensible, but also speaks to the fact that Jesus obviously was the fulfillment of the prophecies. Others have objected to Jesus as being the Messiah based on the idea that the New Testament documents are not reliable. We've kind of hit this one already, that they're artificially concocted to describe things that Jesus never really did, and they just came up with it in order to come up with this. That fails in the light of the actual evidence of what we know. It cannot be denied that the New Testament has proven itself to be the most reliable book in ancient history. It is still used by archaeologists as to describing civilizations, cities where they can be found, topography, as to what to look for. I mean, we talked about it last week. When it says they went up to Jerusalem, you can bet they went up to Jerusalem. Okay. The nation of Israel still uses the Bible in order to plant things that the Bible said used to grow there. When it records people, places, events that are checkable using archaeological means, these people, places, and events inevitably prove to be factual and historical. We talked about last week. So William Ramsey was a skeptic of the Bible until he got the funds to go and explore the Middle East and to research the sites and surprised everybody by coming back a believer. Again, the abundant evidence verifies that the New Testament is accurate and factual. Many of the messianic prophecies documented in the New Testament do not describe anything inherently miraculous. Let that sink in. I mean, we talk about, you know, the miracles of Christ proving him, but what about just ordinary events that weren't miraculous? There was a mundane existence that he went through that could have been, you know, done by anybody, but the way it was done, you know, at the time and stuff, you know, the mundanity of it comes out to be a miraculous thing. There's nothing miraculous about Jesus being buried in a rich man's tomb. Nor is there anything miraculous about Jesus riding into Jerusalem on the foal of a donkey or being betrayed by his friend for 30 pieces. These events are, if not ordinary, at least very plausible, everyday events that theoretically could have happened to anybody. And yet, due to the fact that such everyday events had been predicted about the Messiah hundreds of years before the arrival of Jesus, the fulfillment of the events becomes one of the most amazingly miraculous records of the Bible. I mean, someone who predicts something, you know, Edgar Candace, Gene Dixon, Nostradamus, they're looking for a significant event, something that pops out, you know, in the future that will, you know, make them, you know, appear to be a true prophet. In the Old Testament, again, we talked about this last week, as you go through the prophets, you have, say, like Daniel, we use as an example, who gives an accurate detail of the next four world kingdoms. 550 years before they occur, as you get down to the last one. And then in chapter 11 of Daniel, a very accurate history of what's going on in Syria, in Palestine, in Egypt, in the influx of the Romans and stuff like that. You know, it's very convoluted and complex, yet Daniel is predicting it, you know, major battles and stuff 500 years. With the Messiah, though, it not only predicts the miracles and the big significant events, but it sits there and takes the time to talk about ordinary things that Jesus was going to do. No prophecy has ever concerned itself with that. At least not prophecies by man. But God laid it all out hundreds of years before the fact so that we could look at the life of Christ and go, man, he's doing everything that was said about him. Every last little detail, miraculous or mundane. It is one of the fundamental pillars of the proof for the deity of Jesus is the accuracy of the Bible, it being God's word. Oops, that's it. Got through it faster than I thought. I'd like to spend this last little few minutes, you know, we've got, you know, a couple. It's kind of fitting it into our lives, okay? This is ooh-ah kind of stuff, and hopefully that it does prove to us, you know, along with, the, as we'll look at the miracles and other things, you know, that, you know, that occurred in Christ's life, is, you know, just piling up the evidence that he is who he claimed to be and that he was the Son of God. But even if you prove it to yourself, the only difference that it's going to make in your life is if you let it make a difference. Our country, our world is unraveling. And as it unravels more and more, it gains momentum. I encourage you to read the article in today's bulletin about being concerned about, you know, your own life, where you're headed, what you should be doing, what's important, what's imperative. We're facing some major problems. You know, our government is in many ways becoming anti-Christian. Our school systems are that way. If any, our churches are becoming anti-Christian. More and more, the population of the United States, which at one time was predominantly Christian, is now predominantly just about anything you want it to be. All Faith Chapel on the base is open to witchcraft. The communities that are building up around us are a flavor of, you know, atheism, the gay movement, Islam. You know, we've got enemies on all fronts. The best thing for you to do is to make sure that the one front that you can decide is successful in conquering is the one inside of you. What are you going to do with what you know about Jesus? Specifically, what to do about his teachings. What God has given us is the instruction on how to be moral in this life, how to make proper judgments, how to behave in a way that will promote life itself, your relationships with your families, with your friends, with your employees, with your fellow, you know, students, whatever. Any arena, it's helping you, you know, be the best possible person you can be and infusing your life with the power of God through prayer and God working for you. You vitally need that at this period of time. You need God in your life. You need to convince yourself that the teachings of the Scriptures are the best possible way to live. And you need to begin infusing it in your children. The world is working on them. What are you doing about it? Half the time the children aren't even brought to church. But that's not the problem anyway. The teachers here can only kind of augment what the parents are doing at home. If the parents are not sitting down with their children and teaching them about God and infusing them with morals, the ultimate responsibility of your child going off and doing something really horrendous are at your feet. What you need to do is get yourself squared away first. Get yourself believing seriously in God and in His Word and start implementing it through every aspect and facet of your life. as being more than conquerors, as John puts us, as Christians. The conquering has to start in your own heart, in your own mind, and then ripple out from there. You have to be the best possible moral person and teacher there is in order to influence all those around you. And this is what God calls us to be. And we do not have any excuses. There are none. You may say, well, I'm not a good teacher. Okay? The Bible's full of people that weren't that great a teacher or preachers. God can make do with whatever you are. Okay? Paul had his own problems, the thorn in the flesh. And he figured out finally, it's not what the good things I can do that are, you know, my talents, you know, it's my weaknesses. This is what God works through. So it's not an excuse. And he shows this over and over again. Why did he pick Israel? Not because they're the most abundant nation in the world, but because they were the smallest. And he wanted to show us that he could take us, you know, a nation that was virtually slaves, bring them out of the most powerful nation in the world, set them down in the crossroads of the world at the time between, you know, and surrounded by mighty nations like Babylon and Assyria and Egypt and whatever, and make them prosper. He wanted to show Israel that the king that they needed was not someone big and handsome like Saul, who was going against God, but a lowly shepherd boy who had courage in God and was able, therefore, to stand up to lions, bears, and Goliath. And this is what we need to understand. This is what believing in God is a big amount of trust. If you believe that there is a God, that you're properly, you know, believing in what he says, and have committed yourself in service to him, the next is a step forward in trust. Every time I do this, I remember Ford Carpenter, a preacher that's now, you know, one of the ones I grew up under. And he used to have the story about, you know, a guy that used to walk the high wire. And he kind of talked to the audience, and he'd get up on the wire, and he'd go forward and backward and whatever. And then his final thing was, you know, do you believe I can do this? Do you believe I can do that? Yeah, yeah. He'd get out the wheelbarrow. And he said, do you believe, you know, and, you know, he's going to put a blindfold on, and I'm going to take this wheelbarrow across the tightrope. Do you believe I can do that? And everybody goes, yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. Then he goes, who wants to ride? Are you willing to climb into the wheelbarrow? Do you believe him that much? Do you trust him that much? And this is what God is asking you to do. Do you really believe in God? Do you really believe that he'll be there for you? One of the things that, you know, came out in our study of the early fathers, and once, you know, they got their point across, I could see it in New Testament and in the Old Testament. We talked about Polycarp, you know, as an old man in the arena of Rome who was about to be persecuted. And the emperor asked him, you know, to renounce God and to serve the emperor as God. And he goes, how can I, you know, renounce the God that's been so faithfully looking after me for these 80 years? So he says, he commits himself to the burning. He says, I'll go one better for you. I'll actually stand at the stake. You don't have to tie me to it. And just let the flames come. And it says there was a kind of tranquility on his face. I mean, he wasn't sitting there screaming and yelling and everything else. It was like God was really there comforting him. You go, yeah, how true is that story? But some of the other writers said, it's like at this time of persecution, there were women and children that were hauled off to torture and everything else that went quietly, went peacefully, went humbly, and they didn't scream. There was something that it seemed like God was taking care of them. Is this just the imagination of the early writers? Well, what do we find in the Old Testament? You know, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego going into a fiery furnace and feeling nothing. Nothing even singed. Well, that was the Old Testament. What about the New Testament? What about Stephen? You know, they're rushing on him, they're gnashing on him, you know, they're stoning him to death. And what does he do? He sits there and he says, I see my Lord standing at the right hand of God. And very quietly, very calmly, whatever. Do we believe these things enough to commit ourselves to the things we have to in trust and obedience and believe that God is going to come for us and going to be there for us and see us through it no matter what? Something to think about. If you like that in your life, the invitation is extended. Won't you come as we stand to sing?